Hi, this is Scott Wilkinson, host of Home Theater Geeks. In episode 126, I chat with Mark Waldrop of AIX Records about what's new at his record company, physical media versus online distribution, high-definition audio, and lots more. So stay tuned.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Home Theater Geeks is provided by CashFly at CACHEFLY.com.
This is Home Theater Geeks with Scott Wilkinson, recorded August 27th, 2012, episode 126, High Def Audio. This episode of Home Theater Geeks is brought to you by Netflix. Watch thousands of TV episodes and movies on your PC, Mac, iPad, iPhone, or TV instantly. All stream directly to you, saving you time, money, and hassle. For your free 30-day trial, go to netflix.com/twit. Hey there, Scott Wilkinson here, the Home Theater Geek. This week, my guest geek is Mark Waldrop, the founder and chief engineer at AIX Records, who's been on the show before, and I wanted to get him back to talk about what's new at AIX and a variety of high-quality audio topics. Hey, Mark, welcome back to the show.
Hey, Scott, it's good to see you. Thanks so much.
Thank you. Those who are watching live at live.twit.tv or tuned into the chat room at irc.twit.tv can post questions for Mark as we go, and I'll pass along as many as I can. So, Mark, what's new? What kind of projects have you been working on most recently at AIX Records?
Well, I took a sort of side trip. If people are aware, maybe even the last time since you and I chatted, I was working for a game company for 3 years as a full-time employee, and a year before that, basically as a consultant contractor kind of guy. And so it took me out of sort of the music thing. I would tell people I had three full-time jobs between that one and my teaching at the university, which kicked into gear this morning, unknowst to me. So I missed my first class.
Yeah. You almost missed the show. You had to like jump out of class and say, sorry, students got to run and hop on the freeway.
I could have sworn it was next week. But anyway, as of January, they basically rolled up the carpet on that thing in terms of the production opportunities that were out here on the West Coast. And I came back and kept actually put my foot right back into producing discs that you and I had. I think you were part of that with Rita Coolidge when we shot in the summer of 2010. I shot eight projects using 3D technology, video 3D technology, and just hadn't gotten around to the post-production parts of it. So that was our jumping off point. All of them except Rita, and I'm working on that one right now, as a matter of fact. That's been my summer project here back in May. We put out the Mozart in 3D, the Mozart Old City String Quartet. And then it was because I have a new distribution deal through Naxos out of Nashville for North America. There's a regular flow that's sort of committed to several months in advance, which sort of teed things up for basically two new Blu-ray projects per month, whether they're 2D out of the stuff that we had recorded sometimes 5 and 6 years ago onto stuff that we recorded 2 years ago. It's basically let's catch up with the backlog. As my wife, the controller of the funds around here, basically says, we're not recording any new stuff until we finish producing all the old stuff. And she's quite correct in that, since I had quite a backlog. We did Ernest Ranglin in Blu-ray now, and then a bunch of new ones. And you know, these guys, I don't know if you can see this on the camera or not, but you know, Albert Lee, I had a meeting in the parking lot at Vaughn's on PCH the other night and handed off a disc that he hadn't seen that we actually recorded, 6 years ago. It's taken me a while to get caught up, and it's been particularly intense this summer only because my prime engineer, Dominic Robilato, was involved in a very serious accident, has been in rehab and making his way back slowly but surely. So it's been basically on my shoulders over the course of the summertime to finish the mixing and finish the video and do the authoring and get these things through the replication process and packaged appropriately. But I got to say, it's been really encouraging to get the response that we've gotten on a variety of the discs, both new ones and stuff that we recorded some time ago. One of the guys on one of the websites has basically equated the words AIX Records with, what do I need to say? If all I got to do is tell you it's an AIX Records release and you know the sound quality is going to be five stars, because one of these is going to fall off the five-star review, and that'll be a red-letter day for us as well. But he's been really encouraging with the kind of comments that he's made for, well, we did Brian Petzone, who I went to school with out at CalArts, who's an amazing keyboard player. Wallace Roney, we just finished up. We did one with James Walker and Free Flight, a sort of jazz fusion classical or a classical crossover group.
Those guys have been around for a long time, actually.
Oh, yeah, I peeled a YouTube video of them on 1982 off the Tonight Show and put that on there as a little bonus extra. They've been around a long time.
Wow.
It's not high def, but it counts.
I understand. Why don't you fill us in a little bit, since you haven't been on the show in a while, about sort of the process and the idea, the concept of what you're doing with these Blu-rays and before that with DVDs that makes them unique. And I really do think that they are unique out there in the market.
They're so unique that now that we have a legitimate distribution deal and they're showing up on Amazon, and I got an email back from the legal people at CD Universe this morning, that nobody knows what to call them. I brought a chuckle out of my class this morning, because when I took Brian Pizzone's and pushed it through the distribution mechanism and it shows up on Amazon, it shows up under movies and TV, not under music. And the actors are listed as Mozart, Schubert, and Elgar. Somewhere along the way, the metadata is breaking down a little bit, and people really don't know. Well, if it's a music product, then it can't have video, right? Well, they have video of the entire performance. Then they must be live concerts, which is where the movies and TV angle comes in. So no, they're not live concerts. In fact, I saw a little bit of your comments with your other panelists before. We don't have just one shot at it because there's no audience around. I don't want a PA system or a monitor. In-ear monitors we use sometimes, but no SM57 Shure Brothers microphones and so forth. Essentially, the concept from the outset for me was, and having been a recording engineer for 35 years on, and having been involved in the productions of DVDs and multi-channel stuff for a number of years now, the challenge was, well, okay, I'm going to start a label back with the arrival of DVD audio and SACD back in 2000 timeframe. What would I do that would be different? Because I certainly am not going to be competing with Zomba Records and Jive and the Urban stuff and Arista and all the other normal record labels that are out there. It's clearly what's going to be in the audiophile category. What can I do differently? And it wasn't that I was trying to come up with something completely unique just because being unique would be special. It was the years of experience that I had in recording classical music, including your senior recital, I think, in 1980-something.
Yes, 1981, you recorded my senior recital. That's exactly correct.
Fred of AIX Records, Scott. let's see what we can't do to create some kind of hybrid between what Windham Hill had been doing, and they were, putting microphones, stereo pairs of microphones, very close to instruments. So you get a very intimate, warm sound, rather than what is traditionally done, the Rudy Van Gelder and the traditional classical and jazz ensemble recordings are done with a Bloom Line pair or with a spaced pair 15 feet out in front of the proscenium theater. Everybody's balanced according to where they are physically in the space. My friend Morten from 2L records in Norway in much the same fashion, except with a 5.1 tree up in the middle of the ensemble. Then he makes this plot plan and has everybody strategically placed where they will actually come out in the mix at the end of the recording session. And
so he almost pre-mixes based upon where they are located in the physical space.
Right. That's right. And that was not terribly interesting to me because I sort of dawned on this in response to some questions that were posted through audio stream on Michael's site not too long ago, in that, well, if somebody was commenting, if you record from 15 or 20 or so feet away with the microphones or a pair of microphones, in this case a stereo, which I do all the time, and then you have the additional 8 to 10 feet or maybe more in your living room for your listening position to where that speaker driver is then carrying that microphone signal, you end up with an aggregate of 15, 20, 25 feet away. And for me, that's too far away. I really want to be close. So if you look at the videos of our recording, especially of this piano thing I've been working on with Brian Pizzone, and now Terry Trotter is one of the new ones that we're putting out in October, the microphones are very close. Two stereo pairs inside of the harp, right next to the soundboard, and then they're sort of panned in various ways. And I don't lock down the mixing at the time of the session. I do come in and create a stage and a stereo pair and an audience and stage perspective 5.1. Well, if the sound is coming right from the soundboard into the microphones, that's that very close-up Windham Hill kind of sound. And then if I place that into the driver of the speakers that are carrying those signals to your ears in the listening position, how far away is the piano? It's 6, 8, 10 feet in front of you in the room where you are actually the listener and the participant in that recording session.
This also brings up the point that when you close mic, as you're talking about, you don't pick up much of the room in which the instrument is being recorded. Whereas if you're miking farther away, you're picking up a lot more of that room. Then when you reproduce it in a home, you're adding that room ambience, if you've miked far away, to the room characteristics of the room you're playing it back in. So it's kind of a double whammy there. Another good reason to close mic, and in fact, the reason that I do that as well.
Well, and there's a lot of debates that go on between those people that are into acoustic design and room treatments and the people that say, well, we have to create a dead room because the acoustics of the space are going to then define your room. Well, look, at the end of the day, I do record the room. I've got a chamber music auditorium with 300 seats in it, and there's two BA omnidirectional microphones right in the back of the room. They're carrying the 1.2 seconds of reverb in there because we don't use artificial reverb. We don't use dynamic compression. We stay away from all that processing stuff. If I had to do it in the elevator pitch mode, it's basically rather than, and I'm getting to be an old guy, rather than hauling my tail east of the 405 to go downtown to a live performance venue that might start at 8 o'clock and run till 10 o'clock, it's not my time frame anymore. I would much rather, and it gets sometimes subtle to explain to people, I would much rather have Herbie Hancock or Terry Trotter or Mark Chestnut and his band come to my house and set up in my living room and play a private performance for me. One, the sound is going to be fantastic. No crowds, no SM57 microphones. After all, these are music production. And right. Two, I don't have that person in the 10th row yelling out Freebird in the middle of my live presentation. I'll listen to a live concert a couple of times, but I will listen to an audio recording, John Gorka or some of my favorite people, classical or otherwise, hundreds of times. That's music. Doesn't have to be a video experience. So basically, when you talk about the Amazon listing these things in movies and TV, they really are music with a bonus video component rather than the other way around. I'm not supporting the video. I'm doing it the other way.
We should make it clear that that, as you say, what you're doing is you're recording musical performances, but you're also shooting video during the performance that you're recording in audio. And most recently, you've been doing that in 3D and adding that, as you say, as a bonus to the audio, so that if you want to watch the musicians as they're playing the music that you're listening to, you can do that, or you can turn the video off if you don't want to watch.
That's right. I mean, it becomes a real argument, and I've been thinking more about that sort of from a philosophical point of view lately, because look, we have, because of the technology from Edison and Westinghouse and the rest of them back at the turn of the 20th century, we have divorced the visual from the sonic. We had records, and we're still in that mode, sound files and downloads from iTunes and the rest of it. Well, look, at the end of the day, as you've undoubtedly seen during performances and concerts and playing the music that you play, there is a very visual component to that. I'm a guitar player, and I got yelled at a lot when I had Albert Lee playing guitar with Michael Dorian, a friend of mine I went to school with at Northridge at the same time, as a matter of fact, plays guitar. And they were yelling at me because I had put a music stand up and you couldn't see his fingers. Mm. So the guitar players out there who love Albert Lee had to make sure to see his hands. So when we did his own project on Blu-ray now, I had a camera locked on his fingerboard the whole time. And when he locked into a solo, I made sure that you could see lots of his fingers doing what he does, because that becomes part of it. Is it part of it for every single listen? No. But it might be for two or three, or when you have your neighbors over and you want to see a 3D concert at home, that's when that comes into play. But still, it is very much secondary to the fact that I want some of the best audio on the planet to come through the speakers you've got, and hopefully, you know, get you used to listening in surround.
Right, exactly. And that's another of the unique characteristics of your projects, is that you record all the instruments individually. As you said, you don't pre-mix, you don't mix on the spot. You record them all to separate tracks and then bring them into the studio, into your studio, and mix them. And you offer on these discs several different mixes. You offer the audience perspective surround 5.1, where the instruments are in front of you on the stage, as you would expect if you're sitting in the audience, with ambience in the surrounds. Also, what you call the stage perspective, where you can be sitting in the middle of the ensemble and having music coming at you from all five channels. I think you also provide a two-channel mix as well, right?
Yep. As I was explaining this morning, those are the ones that are available through the usual consumer electronics device, your Blu-ray player in this case. Mm-hmm. There are three more mixes on the ROM section. Because of the proliferation and popularity of music servers, which I think is very much the future, and we'll talk about the downloads here, I know, mm-hmm. I put a FLAC 2-channel 96 kHz 24-bit download. I also put a 320 kbps MP3 file. And the last one, on the most recent ones that we've been making available, we put the Headphones XI, the pre-rendered with the sound of this room behind me, through my ears into a set of headphones, so you can listen as if you were sitting in this room, even while you're, you know, surfboarding or skateboarding down the street.
Right. I've got a couple of questions here in the chat room. Let me interrupt and get to them. Lawn Dog is asking, when you're recording or mixing, probably more to the point, what type of speaker do you use? Monitor, loudspeakers in your studio?
I've been a huge fan for a long time and have gotten a lot of support for trade shows from the Bowers and Wilkins, the B&W people. So I have B&W 801 Series 3, Matrix 3 speakers. I had two, then I bought two more, and then I eBayed my way into another pair from a doctor. So I have there's four of them that are walnut and two of them that are black. And I have now, unfortunately, one is a spare because this is a 5.1 world, and you can only buy speakers in pairs. So, to get companies to sell them in 5.1 sets, they don't when they get this expensive.
Right, right. What about subs?
I have a TMH Profunder, which is made by Tom Holman.
Oh yeah, that's a passive sub, I believe. Right, it requires an outboard amp.
I have a series of Bryston amplifiers in a rack behind me, back in the machine room, that powers the whole thing. A 9B, a 4B.
A. Barron in the chat room asks, how much does your recording setup differ from live sound, like an amplification for a live concert?
It's very different. And that's one of the things you can look at on our website at AIXrecords.com. I added a series of YouTube channels on there where you can look at some of the recordings, video, so you can see where the microphones are. If you look at typical examples, you'll see that there's a stereo pair of microphones in front of most instruments. I don't do that with the lead singer. I don't do that with brass players. Unless there's a group of brass players, then I'll do a wide ORTF on them. A lot of stereo pairs of microphones instead of, you know, inexpensive of mono microphones, which are then electrically panned into their position. If you record with a stereo pair, what you're actually getting is not left and right. You're getting depth. You're getting how far something is away from you. And that's a critical sort of, you know, pre-dawn history, flight kind of response. If you hear a saber-toothed tiger coming after you, you want to know how far away it is before it sinks its teeth into you. So you know distance because we have two ears, in addition to obviously some left and right. Stereo optics is the same way. How far is something away from you based on two eyeballs reading out to that object or image. So I always record with stereo pairs. So it means expensive microphones. I use a lot of Neumanns. I have B&Ks. I've got AKGs. I have a pretty nice microphone collection. And then most notably, a secret that we discovered is you can't throw a U87 Neumann microphone up in front of a singer. It will pick up far too much of the drums and the other instruments that are in the same space. We record everybody, as I said, at the same time. So if we use a ribbon microphone, it's far more intimate sounding. It's warmer. They do work wonderfully with vocals. So John Gorka and Albert Lee, we put a microphone, and an AEA 84 ribbon microphone that my friend Wes Dooley remanufactures or makes, you know, to match the RCA microphones of yesteryear. And we use those for vocals. And it's turned out wonderfully well in terms of being able to isolate that singer from the rest of the other sounds that are in the room at the same time.
Mm-hmm. Lawn Dog asks, what are your thoughts on using all this digital technology for making recordings, seeing as how you came from the old days of analog? And I know you record digitally now. This is one of the topics I really wanted to sort of dig deeply into. So now's as good a time as any. You record, I believe, at 24 bits, 96 kilohertz resolution digitally. So what are your feelings about digital as opposed to recording in analog?
That's a very deep question. Anyone can pick any engineer, producer, artist can pick any flavor that they like in terms of their own particular preference. I mean, there are directors that love to shoot, you know, on 35 millimeter film and process with this look and feel through, you know, post-processing and so forth. So I don't generally like to get in the argument about, well, vinyl versus digital versus, you know, analog tape, etc. Mm-hmm. I will say that the potential to get to what I call high resolution standards or high definition audio is simply not possible using analog tape. It's impossible to do it using a piece of vinyl spinning underneath a cartridge. The only way to get to high definition resolution is to actually record using at least 96 or possibly 88.2 PCM digital with 24 bits. Because if you look at the envelope, the size of that potential fidelity, and I use the word potential because you can always muck it up ahead of that recording stage by adding a lot of really bad microphones, a lot of really bad preamplifiers, and processing it with too much EQ and dynamics compression, all that other stuff that they teach in engineering school, which I teach as well. I mean, they're all tools that are part of the engineer's toolkit, but they're not all necessary. You don't have to make a chain as long and as complicated as you can to get the best sound out. I've opted to go the other direction. I put a microphone up, or two usually, with the ORTF pair we were talking about before, and I do record through a really high-quality A to D converter that Benchmark back in on the East Coast provides, and then we go through into our Nuendo system. I don't record on Pro Tools either. And we record 24 bits wide and do all the post then following. The potential in terms of the actual sound quality, the fidelity that you can achieve by doing PCM at high definition gives us the potential to get to about 120, 25 decibels in signal-to-noise ratio. It allows you the potential to get up to about 48 kilohertz in terms of frequency response. And that I see as a two-sided rectangle. You've got, you know, basically frequency response on the x-axis and then the dynamic range on the y-axis. That's a box. That's a rectangle. The rectangle for vinyl, or for let's go to analog tape, I have, and I've put up on my website, the specifications of a Nagra 4S, a machine made in Switzerland by Stefan Kadelski. And Nagra, it was a very fabulous machine used in all the studios, post-production, and most notably on movie sets and television gigs, because it was highly portable and DC powered. Has all the best electronics, and you crack open the manual on that, and it is capable of recording, even with its own Nagra Master EQ, 72 dB of signal-to-noise ratio. And that's the first-generation master tape. Remember, that's a quarter-inch piece of tape with half-track resolution. Most of the classic recordings that were done on 24-track, or even 4-track, if you go back even earlier, to the Beatles and some of the stuff that was done in the 60s, that's first generation. You then mix that off to a two-track quarter-inch master. You lose 6 dB of dynamic resolution right there. They never, ever mastered off of the master. They made a safety copy, and they cut the vinyl parts off of that. That's another 6 dB. So at the end of the day, even to be generous, if we left it at 72, or in reality at 60, and you know that 6.023 plus 1 times the number of bits gives you the dynamic equivalent in digital, that means that 10 bits to 12 bits worth of PCM resolution will adequately capture all of the analog tape fidelity that's there. And so for me, as wonderful as that is, and a flavor that a lot of people like, and they're willing to pay $15,000 for a refurbed Technics 1500 ISO loop machine and $400 an album from the Tape Project, I'm not kidding when I say to people, I will transfer one of my high-definition audio two-track mixes onto a piece of analog tape one at a time on my stereo Nagra and sell them to you for half that price. Where you can actually get better fidelity, three mixes, full vinyl or full video of the whole thing, and put that in your Oppo machine and play it for, you know, $35. It's a much better deal. People are going to like the flavors they like, but it's absolutely, in my opinion, and it's not so much an opinion as the acoustic facts, it's impossible to call vinyl high definition. It's impossible to call tape, which actually leads to vinyl, high definition. As close as we were able to come was direct metal mastering and the Sheffield Labs and some of those things that Lincoln Majorca did, where you actually had the band play the entire side of an album from start to finish with no mistakes and cut the direct metal at that time. There was no tape involved. But still, those are standard definition releases. They're not high def.
I had a question that just left my mind. Oh, why do you suppose it is then that some people prefer, as you say, they prefer the flavor of vinyl, the flavor of analog tape? If it's not in the resolution, in the dynamic range and the frequency response, what is it?
That's a really hard thing to define. I mean, people like the look of film. People may not like the look of 4K or, you know, even 2K video. It's just something that they've gotten comfortable. I had a very prominent cable manufacturer, the head guy, came by after visiting Southern California in one of the meetings that we had with the Orange County and LA Orange County Audiophile Society, stopped by, and I played him some of the best tracks that I've got in here, including some that had a lot of high-frequency information and things that I was very proud of. And honestly, at the end of the day, he looked up and said, Mark, they're just too clear. There's just too much detail there. He's used to and comfortable with the sound and the distortions and the whatever it is that creates that. I don't say distortion in a bad way. That's, you know, it's a tool and part of the sound world that we live in. But it's just what his ears have been used to listening to all these years. So we have these gradations where I get in most of the arguments that I've had in terms of online, you know, back and forth with people, is that everybody wants to be marketed as high definition or high res. It's better for your business if I can call my recording from 1965 or 68 or take Abco releases of the Rolling Stones. If I can somehow elevate them by putting this little rectangle into the bigger rectangle, the bucket, the digital bucket of a 9624 or even 176.4 24-bit bucket, if I can release them and charge you $30 for that, somehow they magically became high definition. Well, I've done the analysis on these, and so have other magazines swore that's outright fraud. They don't add anything that wasn't there in the original analog tape. Just because you put a drop of water in a sponge doesn't mean it makes the whole thing wet. The bucket is completely empty. So, I mean, look, I just think this is the point of provenance and where the recording was made, how it was recorded, what the technology that was used in making it at the time sort of defined the upper limit of that fidelity, not to mention the target that the producers and engineers and record labels, A&R people on up, had in terms of what they wanted to provide. What they wanted to make was hit records. After all, it's a business.
It is.
But for me, it's less about a business. I'm a college instructor. I own a post-production facility here. And I did it on the Field of Dreams mentality when I started this thing 12 years ago. I will make the very best that I know how to make with no compromises and see if people can, one, tell a difference, and two, whether they will support me with their purchases. And thankfully, 12 years later, there are people, reviewers and customers and people all over the world that say there's just nothing better that they've ever heard. It is maybe an acquired taste, maybe not. And it may not ever find its way onto the radio. But I know that there's enough positive feedback by people online and elsewhere that say it's just, you know, give yourself a nice healthy break between listening to an AIX recording and going back to listen to a normal commercial recording. Because I don't master my records. I spent 13 years as a mastering engineer, but squashing the dynamics of a track in that effort to make it radio friendly somehow doesn't contribute to the veracity of that dynamic curve that was part of the music. Some guy who spent 10,000 hours practicing the drums or the guitar to be able to play a rim shot with you know, very loud dynamics at a split second notice, I want that to be part of the track I record. I don't want some mastering engineer to say, that's out of line. I'm going to smooth that out for you. That's just not where I'm coming from. And I realize, mm-hmm. I recognize that there are others that believe differently, but don't lump them all under the same umbrella and say all tracks are created equal. They all have different targets. They're all done at different times. They're all done with different technologies, and not all of them are high definition.
Beatmaster in the chat room is asking that you mentioned, he points out that you mentioned 88.2 kilohertz as one sampling rate, 96 is another. How do you choose which one to use? Does it depend on the medium that you're going to end up on, or what?
Yeah, it's pretty much the math is, although the algorithms have gotten pretty sophisticated right now, if something started as a CD, and a lot of the download sites that are out there are getting CDs and simply doubling the samples, copying the sample from one to the next slot and calling it magically 88.2, or even 176.4. I'm a record label that's never released a CD. We actually have bundled a couple of CDs with some chamber music stuff for some people in Europe and my local neighborhood, as a matter of fact. But essentially, I'm all about the high definition stuff. So if I'm going to go and record, and I'm not worried about 44.1 as a sampling rate, I start at 96 and multiples of that then are available to me very easily. Going mm-hmm. up makes sense, but coming down to 48 works. And since I'm aligning myself with a video stream, the world of video is all about 48 kilohertz, not 44.1.
Mm-hmm. And what about 192? I was at a recording session yesterday, actually. And the recording engineer was Sean Murphy, a very well-known recording engineer, and we were talking about the difference between 96 and 192. And in both cases, they capture sounds that we can't hear. So the question becomes, why push to 192 if you can't hear what 96 records anyway? He said that it was a matter of space around the instruments. And I wonder how you would respond to that question.
Around space. that's getting a little green magic marker on me.
Okay.
There's a number of reasons. One, there are in fact frequencies up there. I had mentioned Wallace Roney, which we recorded a bit a couple of years ago, and that is just coming out here. Comes out in September, and he played Harmon mute at the end of his trumpet on a number of tracks. Harmon mute generates a lot of very high frequency inharmonic partials. And Dominic, my guy, came out of the studio and goes, "Oh my God, I just can't believe how much high frequency information is in this." Because these speakers actually they don't get up to 48K, but they're well into the 30s. And sure enough, you do an analysis on it, and there are frequencies up to and including 48K in these recordings. So again, I have modified my thinking process to say it's not just for the high frequencies that we do. That filtering and so forth becomes easier as you use PCM and get to higher frequency sampling frequencies, even including 384 now. But what I philosophically and conceptually will explain: if Wallace Roney and his drummer are in that room and all the rest of the musicians, and they are actually creating music that contains frequencies in excess of what we can hear traditionally as human beings in our ears, especially younger human beings compared to being mine, where your ears are supposed to, you know, start to diminish somewhat. If that sound is in that room, I want to capture it. It's part of the music. I'd like to capture as much of it as I possibly can. Now, you recognize that the amount of energy at 48K is very, very slight, but it's still there, and there are frequencies on and up above that. If it's in the room at the time to create the most accurate, the best fidelity that I can possibly do, then I want to be able to put it on the discs that we create and put it back out into the playback environment through the player and the speakers and the amplifiers and the rest of it. Now, speakers are the weakest link. You get a diamond tweeter from B&W Speakers, and they will go out to about 38K. There are super tweeters out there that will go out further than that. But the fact is, even those recordings that are done at 192, the rest of the processing that's done before it ever gets to your speakers kills all of those high frequencies. it mutates them into such a way that you'll never experience them anyway. So that's where you come into this sort of argument about purist recording chain in terms of how you use mic preamps, how you use physical placement, whether you put any filters onto the microphones, whether you do any EQ or dynamics processing while you're recording, whether you do any of those things during post-production, whether you then fresh it again when you master something. And Sean Murphy and the guys that are doing all the kind of work that he does, and that post-production chain that finally makes it into your THX Dolby system in the home, in the theater or the home theater, all that stuff's gone. There's no space left by the time they get done processing that goes into a motion picture. It's not an audiophile sensibility, and it doesn't need to be. But there are some of us out there, myself included, and there are others, I mean, Morton I mentioned a while ago, who really do care about creating the sound of an instrument. Brian Pizzone, the guy I mentioned some time ago that I went to school with and played a piece of mine back in 1989 in New York at the New Music America Festival. Phenomenal pianist. I mean, just beyond the pale. I marvel at his ability to improvise and to play. When he finally came in after 2 years of not hearing what we did in 2010, sat at the edge of the console behind me here, listened to the recording that I played back of his performances in just a solo piano, and said, "Mark, you know, for the first time ever," and he's made dozens, if not hundreds, of recordings, "I'm listening to a playback that actually communicates back to me what I felt when I had my fingers at the keyboard. Most of the time it comes back, maybe it's 70%. I'm getting 100% of what I put into that music back to me." That's sort of the ultimate compliment in terms of what a recording engineer and producer wants to hear. That the music that was made at the moment is actually delivered back through the technology chain that we put together to the artist and to the audience that wants to hear it.
So maybe that's one advantage of recording at these very high sampling rates and bit depths, for that matter, is that it somehow, and I'm at a loss at the moment to explain it from a physics point of view, but it somehow better replicates or represents an emotional component.
There is something there. And, you know, I heard a story, and somebody will go out and look it up, but Rupert Neve, who's a very well-known console electronic, analog electronics designer, did an experiment where they took an 18 kilohertz tone, and they played it for a group of people with ears, people that could really hear, and then they played that as a sine wave, and they played it as a square wave. And if you know anything about physics and acoustics, what's going to happen on the square wave? That's going to have a partial at 36K. That's the first next frequency. And we can't hear that, right? It's well above what humans can hear. So if I play a sine wave at 18K and I play a square wave at 18K through a set of speakers that's capable of delivering it,
they should sound the same.
Sound the same. You know, 85% of the people could tell the difference. How could that happen if you can't tell the difference? Somehow, some way between one that has that upper harmonic and one that doesn't. Now, at the end of the day, like I say, that's not an argument, and I don't worry about the science. If it's in the room, maybe my recordings sound like they do because I'm trying to capture it and give it back to you.
Well, this is all great, and I'm looking forward to continuing the discussion. But before we do, I want to take a moment to thank our sponsor for this episode, which is Netflix. Netflix, of course, gives you the access to thousands of TV episodes and movies streamed directly to just about any consumer electronics device you have in your home. TVs have Netflix apps, Blu-ray players, gaming consoles, smartphones, tablets, computers, of course. Just about anything you have will stream Netflix and display it on any display you have, be it a smartphone, a tablet, a TV, or a computer monitor. You can even start watching something on one device and finish on another, allowing you the ultimate in flexibility and instant access by streaming down from the internet. Netflix is offering to TWiT listeners a 30-day free trial. Just go to netflix.com/TWiT and get started on that. Those few of you who are listening to or watching the show who might not already have Netflix, the free 30-day free trial is at netflix.com/TWiT. And we thank Netflix very much for their support of Home Theater Geeks and the entire TWiT network. So, Mark, I know that we've been talking a lot about producing discs, Blu-rays now, with 3D video on them, 2D video, the difficulty that Amazon has in categorizing your particular titles. But I know that you also, speaking of online distribution, as we were just talking about there a second ago, I was mentioning Netflix, you also offer online distribution with a website called iTrax, iTrax.com. And I wonder how you feel about the difference or the comparison of physical media versus online distribution, and what you think of the argument that a lot of people are making more and more these days that physical media is on its way out and online distribution will take over.
They're absolutely right. They're absolutely right. I heard or read one post that said, 2012 would be the last year of CDs for a number of labels. Maybe in certain parts of the world they will continue to populate. And I did hear another stat that roughly 38% of the revenue by the big record labels came from physical goods this year. The rest of it was digital. Long term, it's obvious. It's just you have to use your crystal ball and figure out what that long term time frame is. Is it this year? Is it 3 years away? Is it 5 years away? Is it a CD? Is it DVDs? I just released the Mark Chestnut. It comes out tomorrow. Mark Chestnut's a very prominent country artist, had about 4 or 5 platinum selling albums. I met him down in Texas doing a video job for my friends at Time Life Records, where he was doing a recording. And so we were producing some little video slugs for YouTube and so forth. And I asked him, I said, would you be interested? I'm a fan of country music. I like it. He's a prominent name. And sure enough, we flew his band out here that summer, and we shot this first country 3D music album, is what I call them. And then he posts it up on his Facebook site, where he's got about 50 or 70,000, Facebook friends. And I was somewhat a little worried because, well, will they know what a Blu-ray disc is, country music fans? Will they appreciate? Well, the header that ultimately came back, or some of the feedback that we got from a number of the fans, was, I don't have Blu-ray. I don't even know what a Blu-ray player is. Some people confuse anything that's a spinning disc with video that comes out is somehow a DVD. So I've had reviewers, even on Amazon and other places, say, this is the world's greatest Blu-ray DVD.
I have to say, I've heard that all too often myself, a Blu-ray DVD. And I'm going, well, no, those are two different things that you're putting together there.
Does it really matter? So I'm thinking maybe we'll regress and make a DVD of that one. But, arriving at physical media that's easy to use, that's fairly inexpensive in terms of the players, drop it in, hit play, and you're good to go, is something that I think a large majority of music consumers will still opt for. As you go to online distribution, and let's divorce that from the video for a moment, and simply have downloaded music or now streaming music, remember, I have to be able to deliver surround sound at a minimum at 96 kilohertz, 24-bit quality. So I started iTrax in the November timeframe of 2007. It was one of the first, I think may have been the first, to offer what I call real high-definition audio downloads. There are other sites, and I alluded to some of them before, that actually call everything high-def, so it means nothing. It's sort of a shotgun approach. If you get a good one, you're lucky. If you 90% of the time you're going to get one that sounds as good as it was back in 1965. It's hardly high definition in my definition anyway. Which, by the way, my definition means it has to meet or exceed the quality, the specs, as it were, of your human hearing. Which means we've got to get somewhere near 120, 130 decibel signal to noise ratio. And hear wherever you'd like, but like I said, I think there's stuff that's up in the 30s, well into the 30s, that will impact your hearing. So anyway, I started the site as a real high-definition audio download. And in case anybody wants to check it out and see, you can go. I started another site. You can go to realhd-audio.com, and you send me an email or fill in the form and send it to me, and I will give you the credentials to download an award-winning high-definition track at 9624 in stereo and see if you can tell the difference. If that sounds like a CD to you, then so be it. I'm not going to argue that you have to spend more money or more effort to try and download high-definition content. But I can say that over the years that I've run iTrax, I get all number of communiques back from people saying, thank you, thank you, thank you. I can't believe it. That it makes this much difference. And guess what? All of the tracks on iTrax were actually recorded at the time the musicians were present at 96K 24 bits. To the exclusion of some people, even good friends that would like to have their stuff included on the site where it was done on analog tape, and it might sound wonderful. And maybe that's, in fact, it is true that I'm going to branch out iTracks. There will be an HD version. There will be an SD version for standard definition stuff, because I've got, what, close to 2,000 albums now that we have to digitize and put the metadata together and put them up on the site for those people that have music servers that want to download the stuff and have them on their local hard drive. And as well, then, the future model is, well, it's in the cloud. I can get it anywhere I want at any time I want, in any fidelity I want. And that's where the problem is, because we have bandwidth limitations.
Exactly. That's what I was going to point out, was that downloading is one thing, and you're talking about downloading from iTracks at 2496. They're probably relatively big files, not compared to video, but still. But then, as you say, then there's streaming. There's coming, storing it in the cloud, streaming it to whatever you want, whatever device you want. And that is a bandwidth limitation. You might have enough at home, but you might not have enough if you're on the road.
Well, even, you know, in my studio here, we get 10 megabits up and down. I can't deliver my stuff as a stream. 10 megabits up and down doesn't meet the minimum requirements for, it would get you maybe Dolby, True HD or something like that. And there are people that are actually starting to look in those directions. Eonkyo, I know, and others are streaming right to their receivers. But at the end of the day, right now, it's still a download world. And I really don't see the telcos and the other companies saying, we really need to move up to capture that last 2% of the population. Who cares about that kind of quality? Music is a commodity. It's a background of life kind of experience. Not in my world, it's not. Certainly, you can use it as a background if you like, and not watch video and not listen in surround or play it through your system that's farming it out through all the places in your house. But for me, that's not the experience. I want you to know that you have the option to sit down and listen to the most realistic, the most fidelity-rich recordings that I possibly can make. And that's not going to happen as a stream anytime soon. Remember, the telephone company decided we want to get 2,000 phone calls through that wire of, you know, 8K bandwidth, not 200 at full bandwidth. And the same thing is true with the satellites. It's the same thing true with the, you know, the copper or the fiber that's coming into yourself. Because people can get more numbers, more channels, therefore more revenue from advertising and all the rest of the economics that make sense to business people. You know, I think of myself as less of a business person and more of a, I don't know, somebody described me as, you know, although the hair is gone, you know, the sort of wacky, crazy scientist trying something new. And I can accept that. I really wanted to push the envelope to see what is possible. And I know that, and hopefully this will happen because of some of the Mark Chestnut and Terry Trotters and some of the more well-known products that we've been doing, is that it will make its way out to the Wynton Marsalises of the world and to the Herbie Hancocks of the world and John Mayer and John Andrasik and other people that can play and sing at the same time rather than worry about Max Martin and you know, Taylor Swift crafting a track, you know, over many months to make a number one hit. That's a different world, a different sound. I'm not criticizing. I'm just saying it's a different production mentality. But when you can get John Andrasik from Five for Fighting to sit down at the piano and play and sing, or John Gorka like we've done, and people respond like the guy who's in the room for me singing and playing, that's, you know, that's at the end of the day, for me, that's the goal.
Mm-hmm. You know, I had a thought earlier, and I forgot to mention it, when you were talking about how analog recordings from tape or vinyl occupy a smaller rectangle of frequency response and dynamic range than what's possible digitally. And sometimes record companies double each sample to get it up to 88 or 96 and say, oh, see, we're high resolution. Reminds me a lot of LCD TVs that do frame interpolation. Now, this isn't interpolation. This is just repeating. But I wonder if some companies do interpolate the audio to try and fill in information between actual samples, much like LCD TVs create new frames of video to fill in between the actual frames of video in an attempt to smooth out motion, but that produce a side effect called the soap opera effect that most people hate. It makes video, makes movies look like video. Do any audio companies that you know of do actual interpolation?
Not the actual label record companies do not do that, I don't think. Mm-hmm. The mastering facilities sometimes will do that. Some of those old tracks that are then generated for downloads in high definition go through that. Well, if I can't get my hands on the analog master, which really to do it right and to say, and I wouldn't argue, I would capture, I was talking to John McEwen from the Nitty Gritty Dirt Band the other day, and they're going to remaster for vinyl the Will the Circle Be Unbroken record, which I did for CD back 10 years ago, and discovered actually that the CD that had been out all those years had the left and right channels reversed.
What?
No. Oh, yeah. No, the first generation Will the Circle CD had the channels left and right reversed. So you take that analog tape, and if I was given the analog tape from Capitol's vault and played it, and it's a DBX encoded master, got the right hardware and got it all tweaked and calibrated just right to do that transfer, I would transfer it at 192 24 bits. I just want the biggest rectangle possible to capture that. Whether arguably there is any stuff up there that high, or whether there's that dynamic range that needs that 24th bit, like I said, I don't believe there is. But as long as you're going to do the transfer, do it at the highest possible rate that you can. But if I was to deliver that to you as a sound file at 44.1 16 bits, you would capture everything. If it was done well, you would capture everything that was on that original analog tape. The idea of interpolation or oversampling is what in the audio world is called, was a hardware decision. So Yamaha and Denon and all these people that made these players would put an oversampling chip on playback. So you give me 44.1 thousand samples left and right per second, and I will basically estimate what the value would be in between two of those samples and generate, for filtering purposes, a better output. Does it make any sonic difference? Maybe slightly, but it's not the same thing as having gone and recorded the actual deal at 96 kilohertz or 88.2 at the time of the original recording. A lot of tricks.
Understood.
But at the end of the day, the only way to make a high-def recording is to make a high-def recording, not to transfer one.
Right. As you say, and as you do, starting from the very beginning, you have the instruments, you have the microphone, you're recording at 2496 or higher even. Right from the get-go, and you keep the files in that high resolution all the way through the editing process and post-production and mastering and everything.
And I think that's more the key than anything else. It's not really a numbers game. I could make a really wonderful sounding CD as well if I stick to the place that I record, the equipment that I record with, the use of stereo microphones, all of that other stuff. The sampling rate and the word size at the end of the day aren't the single biggest thing that makes a difference. I had an early client just call me up and go, crazy, this is so amazing. And I said, well, that's great. What are you listening on? Oh, I'm listening on my DVD video player. This is surround using Dolby Digital. And he said, loved the sound at 448 kilobits per second, only because of where we recorded and the technology and techniques that we used when we recorded them. Look, it's all the better when you go to 96 or 384 or 192. Pick your flavor. But if you're engineering with high frequency and high dynamic range in mind, I get out of the way. Basically, people can't believe I'll mix a whole record in a weekend. One, they're all recorded the same day. The same microphone's got the kick drum. The same microphone's got the snare drum. Once I got the bass and the rhythm section sound and fine in terms of what? Level and distribution in the 5-1 field. There's no artificial dynamics process. I don't have to turn it into a color. I don't have to line them up in Pro Tools so that everything's on the beat. None of that stuff contributes to the kind of recording that I'm interested in listening to. So once I've got them all set up, all I'm doing is adjusting levels. You know, is that solo loud enough? Well, let's bump it a couple of dB when that saxophone comes in. I will do that, and I will actually edit between multiple takes of the same thing. But in terms of, you know, pitch correcting and adding something in terms of reverberation and EQ, a kick drum should sound like a kick drum. You go to a live concert, it sounds like an explosion. That's not a kick drum. It's a sound that works for a live presentation. So people are a little taken aback because the sound of our recordings is very open. It's very spacious. They're very, the colors are true. And they're very different than what people are used to listening to on commercial recordings. Even commercial audiophile recordings are tweaked largely, and that happens on the mastering side. So, you know, I'm imagining a new website that's got, you know, mastering is evil with the red circle and the line through it saying no mastering. Other than putting them in the right sequence and making sure that they're all maximized for the level of the delivery device, I don't want somebody squashing dynamics. I don't want somebody adding EQ and making creative decisions on something that after the output stage of the mixing, I consider done.
A purist approach, that's for sure. In the last few minutes, I'd like to talk about this new thing that you're starting to include on your recordings called Headphone XI. What is that?
Well, look, I've got kids in their 20s. I stand in front of a group of 40, you know, students this morning, and I know that I'm never going to have the same sort of exposure to them with a 5.1 room like I've got behind me, or my home theater at home, or, you know, it's always mom and dads. It's the older generation that's got that sit down, take a listen. So I just struggled so hard with how do I democratize this? How do I get this out to a generation that it isn't sitting in front of a 5.1 surround system. And it dawned on me as I met some people. There's a company called Smith Research. They're in Northern Ireland, a couple of very smart gentlemen there. And then their local guy here, Laura Kramer, who used to be with DTS, has been a friend for a number of years. And they have an amazing box, one of the probably the most revolutionary technologies I've seen or heard in the last 10 years. And when I first experienced it, it was basically having your ears, your personal PNA, the you know, fleshy part of your ear, does that final filtering as the sound then comes to your eardrum and is processed by your brain. And they can actually not make a surround set of headphones, but they can capture the sound of my room or any room with X number of speakers in it coming from X number of directions by putting microphones in your ears and actually then allowing a particular head-related transfer function equation, processing numbers that are unique to you, to be placed between the output of a multi-channel device and a set of headphones. And if I can deliver what your left ear gets from a sound that's over your left shoulder or, you know, in front of you or wherever, and I can put a motion tracker on top, then I can basically take this studio, digitize it, and deliver it through a set of headphones anywhere you want. And it works. People actually do this in the professional world by taking their studio with them or setting up a QC room without speakers and just emulating the big expensive room through a set of these algorithms and this box that they build. Smith with a Y. You can go online and check it out. So I have one of these boxes. A lot of their customers actually will buy the box. Then I had a guy fly from Boston out here for just a couple hours, comes to Southern California, flies, sits in the chair behind me here, and listens to both my THX theatrical system, my 5.1 system with the BMWs, a 7.1 system where I put a couple of 805s in the back, and they have themselves calibrated to those settings, those outputs. Then, when they go back to their apartment or when they're sitting on the plane, they can close their eyes and listen to a surround recording in exactly the same way that they heard it in this room. They walk away with $250,000 worth of speakers, amplifiers, acoustics, build out, and all the rest of the stuff that went through to create this room. So I got the wild idea. Well, you know, maybe there's a generic enough flavor of that head-related transfer function. It's called My Ears that I will put in the box. And so what I do basically is take the output of my Oppo player, the 8 channels or the HDMI actually out, run into the box through my particular calibration setting in the 5.1 AIX room, capture the two channels that's going on its way out to the headphones, capture that in Pro Tools, slice up that file and make them available on both iTunes and on the BD-ROM section of the discs that we're putting out. And miraculously, and I did this back at the Washington, D.C. Audio Fest, which I was back in Maryland, Rockville, Maryland, back in mid-July. And by the way, stay away from the Crown Plaza. I got bed bugs overnight.
Oh,
horrible. Absolutely horrible. And so I didn't have a room. I had a little table and John Atkinson came by, as well as a number of other people, obviously. He wrote it up and put it on one of his posts.
Where I John would, Atkinson I would, John Atkinson, by the way, the editor of Stereophile magazine.
And I would put a set of headphones on the person, and I would, through the remote control of the Smith box that I had there, I would do this in real time. And I would then click center speaker, left speaker, right speaker. And the very second that I hit and soloed, basically I'm playing one speaker at a time, I soloed the right surround speaker. And people's eyes would just bug out. And they'd jerk their head over the shoulder and say, "How? Wait a minute, I'm listening to stereo headphones." So I'd make that circle all the way around, then I'd turn them all on, and they're listening to the sound as if they were listening to an AIX mix through my ears, through that stereo set of headphones. It's remarkable. It's not custom, but it's as close as I can come, and it's so much different than listening to a normal set of headphones. Even the headphones I'm listening to right now, the sound comes out right between your ears in the middle of your brain. You want to be able to pull it out and have it exist in a circumference around the outside of your head. And you can do that with this Smith technology. You don't have to buy the box. Now you can go to iTunes, and Nitty Gritty Surround and Mozart and a bunch of others are available now as Headphones XI downloads. I don't think Apple knows what's going on yet. They're very confused about why is the title got four Headphones XI in it? I mean, it's a little confusing. But again, that's part of what we're planning for the websites that we're going to put together for iTrax HP, which will be iTrax headphone versions of all of the products that we have.
It really now, SCB2 in the chat room is asking, seems like you're now talking about EQ, adding EQ to the recording, which seems contrary to your earlier remarks.
I take the output of the mixes that we've got, and I send them through the Smith box, and the adjustments that they make in two dimensions, both time, phase, and they make adjustments in terms of EQ, the EQ that is actually implemented at your ear, not electrically, but acoustically, on its way to your eardrum.
Ah, so they're simulating the EQ that your, in this case, your ear, applies to the sound as it enters your ear. Ideally, right. the Smith box, if you bought the Smith box, which is expensive, it's thousands of dollars, I think. Set it up so that it applies the acoustics of your own ear and your own room.
Well, you wouldn't want your own room. What you want to do is walk away with my room.
Ah, yes, because your room is really super cool.
Well, yeah, and that's the thing that Laura does here in Southern California. Somebody comes by and they'll go to Mikasa Studio or they'll go to the Egyptian Theater or they'll come here as one of the rooms that they want to model and walk away with, because then they can listen with that experience in their headphones at home. It is EQ. It's not me adding EQ. It is the EQ that's as a result of those directional cues that your ears have to experience in the midst of a room. They call it the Smith Room Realizer, not surround headphones, because if I had two speakers in here, you could do that as well. That leads me to sort of the idea, I think, to cap where I'm going, is iTrax offers right now 21 different versions of each track, everything from MP3 up to and including lossless FLAC and PCM in any one of three mixes, an audience or stereo or stage perspective 5.1 and stereo. We're going to go further than that and offer the Smith realized versions and so on and so forth. So what this leads to, I think, is the dawn of a really exciting new trend with digital music when discs are no longer involved, as we were talking earlier, into the world of personalized digital music delivery so that you will get a flavor that meets best your tastes and preferences and even the shape and contour of your ears, and I'll get a different one. And every customer will get their own unique flavor of a particular mix.
Mm-hmm. Menace in the chat room is asking, does AIX have a demo record or a free download to check out some of these things we've been talking about?
Well, as I said, Real HD hyphen audio will give you a high resolution download. I don't think I've made a headphone version, but you can go to iTunes and Nitty Gritty Surround for Headphones XI is one of the flavors that you can type in and search for and play the 30-second samples that are on that site and listen through headphones, over-the-ear headphones, and you'll hear the effect that we're talking about.
What about earbuds? Does it work for earbuds as well? In-ear headphones?
You have to have over the ear because part of the processing is taking place by the ears that are inside the headphone.
Mm.
Part of that calibration process that Laura does when he comes here is to make sure that the headphones passing the sounds around the convolutions of your own ears is accounted for as well. If it goes right through earbuds, they just don't have the fidelity. And in fact, if you buy the Smith system, the Smith box, it comes with a set of electrostatic Stax headphones, which is a very expensive and very well set of headphones. They want to make sure that the headphones do the best possible job. Now, I bum around with a set of AKGs or Sony headphones at the trade shows, and the effect is still very apparent. I just want to make sure that it's not subtle. It's not, oh, is it on? Is it off? No. I did a demo with Eleanor Rigby because it was all strings, and I have the DVD audio of that disc, which means I could actually break out the 5.1 surround. I added my own voice saying left front, and there would be, and then as they sing each phrase, it goes around. Then I turn it on with all five. Then I go back to the stereo standard headphone mix. And look, there's going to be plenty of people that like it the traditional old way inside your head. That's how we grew up. But there's enough people that will say, after listening to that for a while, I kind of like it outside of my head. The only other alternative, Scott, that I have come up with is everybody's got to wear a sombrero with little dingle ball Bose speakers at 5.1 position so you walk around and get around.
Well, I think we'll leave that till next time. I want to thank you so much, Mark Waldrop, for being on the show today. It's been a fascinating hour, and I'll look forward to having you back sometime soon.
Thanks, Scott. Thanks so much.
Thank you. You can, as we've been saying, you can reach Mark at AIXrecords.com, and his download site is iTracks, iTRAX.com. And you can also remind me, Mark, again, the download site, RealHD-Audio.com.
Yeah, and if you fill out the form, it may take me a day or so, but I will send you the credentials where you can actually download a high-def file.
Cool. You can reach me, of course, at scott@twit.tv, and you can send me questions or suggestions for guests for future shows, and I look at all of that stuff and appreciate any and all feedback that comes my way. Next week is Labor Day, next Monday, so we won't be here. We'll be taking the day off from our labors. And the following week is the CEDIA Trade Show. That's the Custom Electronics Design and Installation Association. And I'll be at that show looking at all the latest and greatest in custom installation gear. There's a lot of projectors that happen at that show that are introduced there. So the following Monday after that, we will be I'll be doing a wrap-up from CEDIA with all the cool new stuff we saw there. So I do hope you will join me for that. Until then... Geek out.